Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. Jake Halpern and Peter Kujawinski's novel Nightfall puts your imagination in overdrive as the characters face 14 years of night and creatures that are not happy to have humans on their island. I spoke with Halpern about the novel and how he and Kujawinski decided to plunge their world into darkness.
My wife and me and our two little kids lived in India for a year. And when we were living there, the power would go out, you know, fairly regularly. The power went out so often, in fact, that when someone would turn the lights off in our apartment, my little three-year-old would say, "Power's out." And I think that it made me feel the same way that I feel sometimes when I've gone camping, which is just that when all of a sudden you're plunged into more or less complete darkness, there's a feeling of being powerless. And there's also just a frightening feeling. And I think it's one that, like in a first world country where we can pretty reliably count on there being light all the time, we just lose touch with. And I think when I was writing this book, I was trying to channel into that sense of fear and uneasiness that I had either when the power went out in our home in India or just when I would take the kids camping and the sun would set and that creepy darkness would kind of come over you. And that was really what I was trying to tap into.
You tapped into it very, very well. Just the feeling, I mean, even when I'm going from my car to the house and it's nighttime and there are no lights on and we don't have streetlights, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I have no idea what could be lurking in the shadows. And you do that throughout this entire novel.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think that was really the kind of beating heart of the book was this feeling that I think we can all relate to, which is just an uneasiness about the darkness. And in some ways, downright fear. But I think it's always there, even in modern life, this sense of kind of wanting to scamper quickly down a darkened alley or get quickly from the car into the house, because something about not being able to see and the blackness, it makes the hairs go up on our spine. And I'll just add one little thing. It's funny, my wife is a scientist. She's a professor here at Yale, and she's a super rational person. And when I had a conversation with her at one point, and she said to me, "Well, I'm scared of the dark, too." And I was like, "Wait a minute, though. You're like a Vulcan. You're like the most rational person I know. How could you be scared of the dark?" And she said, basically, look, ever since the earliest time of man, night was a time of great vulnerability. Night was the time when bad things happened, when they came to get you. And if you weren't scared of the dark, you weren't going to survive. It was evolutionarily advantageous to be scared, to be rightfully scared of the dark. And just because we live in a world where that's often no longer a threat, we're still hardwired in that way. So when you're scurrying from your car into the house, some ancient part of your brain and some old evolutionary mechanism is firing and telling you, danger, danger, danger. And you can't just switch that off.
Now, our characters in this book, there's been 14 years of day. And so once the day portion of those 14 years starts to decrease and they know night is going to happen for 14 years, everybody on this island, and the island is called Bliss, so you think it's a wonderful, idyllic place to live, but they know they have to leave. And nobody will tell our character, Marin, what happens when it becomes dark and why they leave.
Right. And of course, the island is called Bliss, you're right. And you know, it's kind of a play on the old saying, ignorance is bliss. So in the town, basically, everyone is packing up to leave, but they're preparing the houses in these bizarre ways. They're rearranging the furniture. They're taking the locks off all the doors, and they're hastily getting out of there. And Marin and her brother are basically asking questions about, particularly about why they're changing, moving stuff around in the house. And the parents are basically falling back on this explanation of like, hey, this is just the ritual. We always leave the houses this way. And we come back 14 years later at sunrise. Everything is as we left it. And Marin and her brother, Kana, are skeptical of this. They think that there must be some other reason. And of course, there is, because when the sun sets, there are other things that live on this island that come out.
And it's just so interesting how you write the villagers refurnishing the house in different ways. They're given floor plans on where different things went. And there are these giant, giant metal plates. They're thinking, what in the world? It's like you're setting up the house for a dinner party, but they're going to be empty for 14 years. Why are you doing this?
Right. And Marin and, you know, so Marin and Kana, they're 14 years old. So they're at that age anyway, where they're kind of questioning their parents. And they're saying, you know, something's going on here. And the parents are falling back on this explanation that this is ritual, this is the way we do things. And there's one point where Marin says to her father, like, is it that simple-minded? You're just doing what you're told? Like, tell me the truth. And the father turns to her and says, you know, Marin, sometimes being an adult is accepting that we don't know. We don't know why we do the things we do. We just do them kind of blindly.
There is this scurry because everybody leaves all at once and they're dependent on the furriers, which bring the big boats, and they're coming from the north. But one of the other village teens gets lost. So, of course, they go hunting for him because it's their best friend. And Marin and Kana, they're twins. So, I mean, they already have this bond. And then their best friend, you, of course, one can't go without the other twin. And then they're not going to leave their best friend behind either.
Right. We set it up so that the cycle of day and night is quite epic. It's 14 years of day, 14 years of night. But we also create this tide. It's kind of actually based on the Bay of Fundy, where there's a mile-long tide between high and low. So we just exaggerated that, and we said there was a 500-mile tide. So what was once the ocean becomes kind of this just desert, and that the tide turns very rapidly, and that the boats ride out on this tide. All of this means the timing is very crucial, and if you don't leave exactly when the tide turns, you know, you can't go. So it means that there's some confusion at the departure, and as you say, the two kids go to rescue their friend, but when they get back, the tide has turned and the boats are gone, and they're left kind of stranded on this island and all of a sudden dealing with what this island is transformed into at night.
And that their eyes have never been trained to see in the dark. I mean, when you're living in 14 years of light and they have yet to cycle through to the next place that they go to 14 years where night does come every 3 days, but they're really just powerless.
They are. I mean, it's interesting. One of the characters, the brother Kana, has this strange condition where he's able to see fairly well. They thought he was blind during the years of daylight, but it turns out his eyes just had a very high sensitivity to light. So there is this kind of wrinkle where the sister Marin and the friend Line are blind as a bat. They can't see anything. And they become wholly dependent on this brother. It's kind of a role reversal where the brother has been blind through much of the years of light, but now that the light is so low, he can see quite well, and they're dependent on him. And their dependency on him creates these issues with power and trust among the three of them because they're totally trusting of him. And he's got something going on. We won't have any spoilers, but that complicates that. And as part of this, like, I remember at one point, folks live up in the Berkshires, and I went on a hike at night just to kind of feel what that was like. And I remember being about 100 feet from my parents' house into to the pine forest behind their house. I was so close to the house, I could still hear the purr of my parents' hot tub. And yet I was kind of freaked out because I could see nothing. And that feeling of powerlessness was exactly what I wanted to channel into them kind of making their way through the island.
You absolutely hit the nail on the head about the trust issues, because Kana has had to wholly trust his twin Marin and his best friend Line to help him. And that trust gets broken in the story while Kana is still basically blind in the light. So having those roles reversed, it's really hard for Marin and Line to trust Kana now because they've grown apart.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the dynamic. The story is really, I almost think of it cinematically as an extreme close-up. It's really the dynamics between these three teenagers in this very impossible situation. And each of them has something going on with them.
We get, just like our characters, get glimpses of these things that emerge in the dark, but we never really get the full picture, so it leaves it to our imagination. I think imaginations just make things 100 times worse than
correct.
If you had said, this is what they look like, but we only get any pictures of their feet or just eyes staring at them. And so, I mean, I'm just imagining these huge, huge things coming at them or just hiding in the darkness and just seeing a shadow of them.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the technique that we play with in the book is basically a very slow reveal and never really showing you what these things exactly look like, and you get a glimpse at the very end. And the origin of this, interestingly, my wife grew up in Poland, and she used to play a game in the forests in the far north of Poland, where she and her brother would walk into the woods And the only rule was you couldn't look back over your shoulder. And it sounds simple enough, but, you know, a few minutes in, there would always be a branch that would snap. And then this kind of burning desire to turn and look to see what's behind you. And when you can't turn, which the rules say you can't, a switch gets flicked, and that switch is your imagination. And you start imagining what might be behind you. And, of course, nothing is ever as bad as the fear, the gnawing fear of not knowing. That frightens us more than anything. And so I played this game with her when I went back to Poland, and it was really scary. And I think that that was what we wanted to do with the book, is create that same gnawing uncertainty and inability to know what's right behind you.
That is a horrible game.
Ah, yeah, it is. No, it is. My wife has lots of those games that they play with, like really scary stuff.
The name of the book is Nightfall. Jake, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for making time.
Again, the name of Jake Halpern and Peter Kujawinski's novel is Nightfall. It is published by Putnam. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.